ready to conduct the meeting.
Good evening. Let's call to order the Heritage Preservation Commission meeting of August 6th, 2025 at 7 p.m. The city does not tolerate disruptive behavior in our meetings. Sunnyvale prides itself on the rich diversity of our residents. We are committed to creating a culture of belonging where members of our diverse communities feel included, safe, and respected. This Heritage Preservation Commission meeting is considered a limited public forum, which means the commission can regulate the time, place, and manner of speech. Speaker comments must be limited to the agenda item being considered by the commission for consent calendar or public hearing items. Speaker comments during oral communications must be limited to matters within the commission's authority, generally referred to as within the commission's subject matter jurisdiction. If a speaker's comments are not related to an agenda item, the presiding officer will rule the speaker out of order. A speaker will not be ruled out of order because of a disagreement with the content of their speech. Location and online meeting details are available on the Heritage Preservation Commission agenda. Scan the on-screen QR code or click the language access and translation link in the meeting agenda to read and listen along in more than 60 different languages. Use the Show Captions button to view captions on Zoom. Comments on matters not on the agenda or presentation items must be submitted prior to the time I call the item for oral communications. Comments on agenda items must be submitted prior to the time I close the public hearing on the agenda item. Speakers are requested to keep their comments to the time period set for public comments for the agenda item, which will be strictly enforced. Guidelines are posted on the city's website and on the commission meeting agenda. Please join me in a salute to the flag.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Recording officer, may we please have the roll call?
Yes, Vice Chair. Is there Commissioner Garrett? Commissioner McManus? Commissioner Rajkumar? Commissioner Rawal is absent. Commissioner Sharma
Present.
and Vice Chair Zafair.
Present.
And Chair, we did get notification of Chair Johnson's planned absence via email. So the vote is 5 present and 2 absent.
Thank you.
We have quorum.
Moving on to our next item, 250801. Is there a staff presentation?
Yes, good evening, Commissioners. Momo Ishijima, Senior Planner, and I'd like to welcome Mayor Klein back as liaison to the Heritage Preservation Commission. Tonight we have a CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act training by Sandy Lee, our Senior Assistant City Attorney. Thank you, Sandy.
Thank you. Good evening, commissioners. Sandy Lee from the Office of the City Attorney. Happy to be with you here tonight. I understand that several of you may have had a similar presentation a year ago, so this will be a bit of a refresher, which I think in CEQA may be welcome because it's a complicated subject and it may be new material for some of you. I don't know. Okay. So this is, we call it CEQA 101, with a focus on historic preservation issues. Where am I supposed to? Okay, there we go. Okay, and this is the question we're going to be addressing. What is CEQA? Oops. Okay. All right, so the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, is a state law that was adopted quite a few decades ago, and it applies to discretionary actions by public agencies in the state, from the state to local levels. It is also implemented through guidelines that are issued by a regulatory agency called the California Natural Resources Agency. So it's the Public Resources Code statute together with the CEQA guidelines that constitute what we know as CEQA. And the purpose of the statute is really several fold. Principally, it's to inform government decision makers and the public about potential environmental effects of the government's proposed activities, and to identify ways that environmental damage can be avoided or reduced, and then to prevent those that damage by requiring feasible changes to the project by adopting an alternative or incorporating mitigation measures. And CEQA is a complex law that is amended frequently by the state. The guidelines are amended from time to time as well. And there are many, many lawsuits involving CEQA. And it's an area of law in land use that has, before the housing laws became more and more complex, I think we consider this to be the particularly complex part of land use law. Okay, so. The fundamental requirement of CEQA. Basically, a public agency can't approve a project if there are alternatives or mitigation measures that would avoid or substantially lessen the environmental effects of the project, unless those alternatives or mitigation measures are infeasible due to identified economic, social, or other conditions. So that this is what we'll get to is called like a statement of overriding considerations. If there are certain benefits to the agency, to the region, to the community, to the public that outweigh the environmental effects, the project can still be approved. And so principally, CEQA is an informational process that engages the public to disclose a project's environmental effects, but it doesn't dictate the outcome. And an agency can approve a project with significant environmental effects based on the needs of the city and the community. Okay, so this is just an overview about the CEQA process. It can be a lengthy process. It's a short process for some projects, but it starts with the question of whether or not what we have at issue is a project as defined by CEQA. And a project is an activity that may cause either a direct physical change in the environment or a reasonably foreseeable indirect change in the environment. So basically, it's something that physically occurs in the environment. So if what we have before us is a project, then the first question the agency deals with is there a CEQA exemption that applies? And I'll speak more about what exemptions are in the next slide. But if after this preliminary review, the agency determines that there is no applicable CEQA exemption, then the agency must consider what level of CEQA review is needed. And so the agency undertakes what's called an initial study. And what comes out of the initial study is a determination whether or not a negative declaration, a mitigated negative declaration, or an EIR will be prepared. After the document is prepared with required public review and input, the document, as well as the project, will come before the decision maker, which will be required to make findings as required under CEQA about the environmental effects of the project. Then the decision maker can either approve or deny the project. And afterward, the agency will file what's called a notice of exemption if it's the project is exempt, or a notice of determination if one of these other documents is adopted. And that will start the statute of limitations running. Okay, so this is basically the first step after you've determined that you have a project before you. is the project exempt? And there are two types of exemptions. One is called like a statutory exemption, and as the name suggests, it's created by statute by the state legislature. And these are generally activities that the state wants to promote. So some of these exemptions will apply to projects that clearly have environmental impacts. I think one of the statutory exemptions has to do with activities involving Olympic Games. And so many of those activities do have impacts. But it's basically a way for the state to say, we've already determined that there's benefits to this activity, so we're going to consider it exempt under CEQA. So there's this other category of exemptions called categorical exemptions, and these are created in the CEQA guidelines by the a state agency. And unlike statutory exemptions, these are categories where there are not significant environmental impacts. And there's 33 classes of projects with categorical exemptions. And these are some of the more common ones. You know, class one is, it's called the existing facilities exemption, and it deals with minor alterations of those facilities with a negligible or no expansion of use. Class three, I think that one is actually, it's like minor construction, new construction or conversion of small structures. And that can be up to three single family homes in an urbanized area and up to four commercial buildings less than 10,000 square feet. And then class 31 is probably the one that you may see more frequently. And it's a class, a categorical exemption for rehabilitation of historic resources, meeting the Secretary of Interior standards. And then there's class 32, which is the urban infill exemption. Those are some of the more common ones that we use. Okay, so if it's been determined that the project is not exempt from CEQA, then prior to considering the project for approval, the agency must engage in environmental review, which starts with an initial study. And so the initial study determines what kind of CEQA document will be required. It also is a study that will identify enough issues and potential mitigation so that a project could be modified to eliminate significant environmental impacts. It helps to focus the EIR to eliminate some areas that there are certainly not going to be environmental impacts. And then it provides a factual basis to justify the choice of a negative declaration or a MND other than an EIR. And then it also is the factual basis to justify tearing off of a prior CEQA document, basically using a previously certified CEQA document and creating a narrower document that just focuses on certain issues. Okay, and so this is the stage where the city requires studies like historical resources reports. And so these are all of the environmental impact categories that are reviewed in the initial study. And there's a series of questions in the CEQA guidelines. It's called Appendix G. And so there's a series of questions that goes through each of these categories so that the city can determine whether or not there may be a significant impact in these categories. Okay, so a negative declaration or MND. They're related. If the initial study shows there are no significant impacts or all the significant impacts can be mitigated to a less than significant level, then one of these documents will be prepared. So if there's no impacts at all, so no mitigation is needed, then the city prepares a negative declaration. And then if mitigation is needed, then they prepare a mitigated negative declaration. And so the common examples of mitigation will be things like dust control measures, construction noise mitigation, tree preservation measures, and dealing with preserving the habitat for nesting birds and preserving tribal cultural resources. So the process with the ND or MND is that it has to be circulated for public review and comment. And then the decision maker must consider and adopt the ND or MND prior to approving the project. Also, if there are advisory bodies along the way, they also must consider the ND or MND prior to making their recommendation. But the advisory body doesn't take action on that on the CEQA document. And then any mitigation identified must be included in the project. Okay. So an EIR is required. There's EIR is a bit more involved, but it's required whenever a fair argument can be made that the project may have a significant environmental impact that can't be mitigated. Okay. And so if there's substantial evidence supporting a fair argument that the project may have a significant effect on the environment, the city would need to prepare an EIR. And substantial evidence just is a relatively low threshold. I mean, it's facts or reasonable assumptions based on facts, expert opinion based on facts, and lay evidence, by a non-expert is okay if it's fact-based and not technical, if the area is not technical. But the things that don't constitute substantial evidence are argument, speculation, unsubstantiated opinion, clearly inaccurate or incorrect evidence. So not every comment constitutes substantial evidence. But I think if there's kind of a battle of the experts on an issue, the agency prepares an EIR. And so in general, the agency has about a year to complete and certify the EIR. I would say that for complex projects, of which there are many, that time frame is longer. And within that time frame, these are the activities that there's a scoping meeting involving the public and other interested agencies to kind of focus the EIR. Then the agency issues a notice of preparation of an EIR. And then, at each stage, public comment is solicited. And then ultimately, there's a draft EIR prepared, with a project description, description of the environmental setting, the analysis of the environmental impacts, the proposed mitigation measures, a discussion of alternative projects. It's usually a fairly robust document. The draft EIR will then be re released for public review and comment. And then those comments received during that period will become part of the final EIR, and the agency must respond to all comments that are any written re comments that are received during that period. Those responses also become part of the final EIR, and then there's a public hearing on the project and the EIR. Now, the agency isn't required to hold a hearing on the EIR during the circulation period. However, Sunnyvale does routinely do that. I mean, solicit significant public comment through at least the Planning Commission and perhaps other venues. Okay, so one aspect of an EIR that's quite different from an MND or an ND. Is that the agency needs to evaluate project alternatives. So the EIR has to analyze a reasonable range of alternatives that would attain, I think, most of the project's basic objectives, not all of them, and then avoid or substantially lessen the significant effects of the project. And one of the alternatives has to be a no project alternative, like if we didn't do this project. So the alternatives analysis has to include an explanation of why what was considered and what was rejected as an alternative, and whether it's because they were considered not feasible, wouldn't attain the project's objectives, or wouldn't reduce the significant effects of the project. And so usually, there's probably, depending on the complexity of the project, at least two. But most often, I think you'll see kind of 4 to 6 different alternatives. And for historic resources projects, usually the alternatives will include a preservation alternative and sometimes multiple preservation alternatives with preserving different aspects of a site if there are multiple historic resources on that site. So the agency must also in the EIR identify the environmentally superior alternative, which is the one with the fewest environmental impacts. But the agency is not ultimately required to choose that alternative. All right. So the EIR also has to consider all of the significant impacts and make a determination whether or not the impact can be mitigated to a less than significant level. And it also has to identify the impacts that remain significant and unavoidable because either no mitigation exists, the mitigation is not feasible, the mitigation may reduce the impact, but it won't reduce the impact to a less than significant level, or the mitigation is unconstitutional. And so, if there are impacts that remain significant and unavoidable, the agency has to adopt a statement of overriding considerations in order to approve the project, despite those significant and unavoidable impacts. And the statement is really an explanation of the benefits of the project that outweigh those significant environmental impacts. And so CEQA is partially about efficiencies, and so to the okay, that's okay. So when we the city is engaged in like higher level planning efforts, creation of specific plans, amendments to the general plan, the city will do or will prepare a program level EIR, basically that assesses a wide range of activities, the environmental impacts of those activities and mitigation measures that are required, and then they may reserve the ability, basically the need for projects to look at impacts on a project level later, but. Where an EIR has been certified already for the area in which the project is located, such as a specific plan, typically the city would look at whether or not the city could use that previously certified EIR in part to address the environmental issues of this project, and then we'll focus the study on whatever wasn't assessed in that program level EIR. So there are factors in the CEQA guidelines that say what the agency needs to consider to determine whether or not a subsequent EIR has to be prepared, or whether or not the city can just make a determination of consistency with the prior document, or prepare an addendum, which is basically saying there's some small changes needed, but there are no new significant impacts. Okay, so just to really quickly recap, if a project is determined exempt, the city just makes findings that it's exempt, factual findings, and then files a notice of exemption. If there's no significant impacts, then the city prepares a negative declaration and adopts one. And then if there are impacts, but they can be mitigated to a less than significant level, the city will adopt a mitigated negative declaration. And then if there's a fair argument that some impacts can't be fully mitigated, the city prepares an EIR. And if there are significant unavoidable impacts, the city adopts a statement of overriding considerations. Okay. So that was a quick run through of the CEQA steps. Now we're going to move on to the historic resources under CEQA. So historical resources are part of the physical environment. The CEQA guidelines addresses historic resources directly and states that an EIR has to be prepared if the project has the potential to eliminate important examples of major periods of California history or prehistory. And then we've already talked about when there's a fair argument that a project may have a significant impact on a historic resource, an EIR must be prepared. And the categorical exemptions we talked about, they can't be used for a project which may cause a substantial adverse change in the significance of a historic resource. Okay, so what are historical resources? The Public Resources Code defines these in three categories. One is like mandatory historic resources. And these are those that are listed or eligible for listing in the State Register of Historical Resources. So those have to be treated as historic for purposes of CEQA review. Presumptive historic resources are those in the local historic register. And those are just, they're presumptive, so there's, you know, but they can be, there can be evidence. If there's a preponderance of the evidence that shows it's not historic, then the agency can treat it as not historic. And then there's this category of discretionary historic resources. And so if, even if a resource is not on the historic register, the agency can make a determination based on substantial evidence that there is some historic significance to this resource and therefore will treat it as a historic resource for CEQA purposes. So just because it's not considered a local landmark yet doesn't mean, you know, the agency has no ability to treat it as a significant historic resource. Okay, so basically, there's an environmental impact to a historic resource if there's a substantial adverse change in the significance of the historic resource. Negates the seeks, okay, that normally applied to. So a substantial adverse change would include the demolition, I think, obviously, of a historic resource. But it can also involve the relocation of the resource or alteration of it or its immediate surroundings that kind of impact the historic significance of that resource. And then materially impaired includes, again, I think demolition is pretty obvious, but, you know, alterations can also constitute material impairment. So some mitigation that's often included when we have a historic resource is to require the project to comply with the Secretary of Interior standards for the treatment of historic properties. Mitigation can include some redesign of the project to eliminate some aspects that damage the resource. That can be like preservation, like preservation of certain aspects, because sometimes, you know, a developer may not want to preserve anything, but it's feasible to preserve some parts of a resource or the site. Another mitigation is can include relocating the historical resource, although relocation itself could be a substantial adverse change. And I think it's pretty unlikely to reduce the impact to less than significant. And then there's like mitigation involving like documenting the resource through photos, markers, displays, things like that. But again, this is not going to reduce the loss, the effect of losing the resource to less than significant. And that would still, if this is the only mitigation, a statement of overriding considerations is going to be required. Okay, so I understand this has some significant relevance in Sunnyvale. I mean, I think this happens. Heritage tree preservation is an issue in, I think, many cities. And so there's an ex this is just an example of when a housing project requires the removal of a heritage tree of local significance. And so, you know, potential mitigation for this impact could include redesigning the project. But we have to think about, is redesign going to be feasible given the size of the site and the kind of the density that's desired of the in the housing project? Another potential mitigation that's common is like replanting new trees, but this will only be partial mitigation. And again, requiring the developer to dedicate land to create a park. This is probably going to exceed the ability because it's going to exceed the impact of the loss of the resource, and so that is less likely to be a legally feasible mitigation. And so, essentially, it's most likely that there isn't going to be sufficient mitigation to reduce the impact to less than significant, and so some possible overriding considerations the city might adopt are that the general plan designates the ha site for housing. There's a need for housing, and that the project may offer other community benefits. And then I think if there's some issue with the tree, like the tree is diseased, that could also be a factor to consider. Okay, so historic resources, it's a frequent area of CEQA litigation, but I guess I would say there are many areas of frequent CEQA litigation. And so these are some common issues that we're gonna address in the cases that are coming. Okay, so this is sort of one of the older cases involving historic resources, in the 90s. We may all remember Montgomery Ward. I do. So anyway, Oakland approved a plan to demolish this historic Montgomery Ward building. And back then, I think there was cities more frequently used mitigated negative declarations. And so the city did so here, and they found the loss of the building could be mitigated to less than significant by a historical survey report and commemorative plaque. I mean, I think now we realize that this is not going to be adequate mitigation. But back then, I think, this was a relatively early case. So the court held that the city should have prepared an EIR. It was eligible for listing in the California Register, so it was a mandatory historical resource. The loss of the building wasn't adequately mitigated. So I think that's basically when there's demolition, there's not really going to be adequate mitigation to justify anything other than an EIR. So anyway, in the end, though, after this battle of the preservationists and neighborhood activists in the city, the building was demolished. And the site was redeveloped. And this, I think, shows that CEQA governs the process, but not the ultimate result. It can't fully protect a historic resource from demolition. There's this case from Monterey Architectural Heritage Association versus County of Monterey. And this involved an old historic jail in Salinas, where Cesar Chavez had been incarcerated briefly in the 70s. And even though this also involved a demolition, the county prepared an MND that concluded the loss could be mitigated by photographic documentation and some other steps. So again, the court held that the agency violated CEQA because it did not prepare an EIR. But the even though the building was not unique in its condition, its poor condition diminished the architectural integrity. The court still felt there was enough evidence that it was potentially eligible for listing on the state and national registers due to its association with a historic farm worker movement. The jail is still there, as far as I know. I mean, I don't think, unless something happened this year. And so nothing has really happened there. So, okay, so this case out of City of West Hollywood, 2017. Okay, the City of West Hollywood approved a mixed-use project that involved the demolition of a building that was considered architecturally significant, eligible for listing in the California Register. The city, unlike those two prior cases, the city certified an EIR and adopted a statement of overriding considerations. The city didn't dispute that the building was historic, identified the loss of the building as significant and unavoidable, and was only partially mitigated. And the city determined that the preservation of the building was infeasible, and had some facts to support that. And then the city, so also a feasibility issue is like whether or not the project will meet most of the basic objectives of the project, whether or not the alternatives will meet the basic objectives of the project. And the city said that the alternatives would not, because the city, one of the objectives was to have an iconic gateway development with certain features, and the preservation of the building would disrupt the site design, and the alternatives wouldn't contribute as much to the city's economic base. So these are all acceptable justifications to approve a project despite environmental impacts. There's a lot of deference in the selection of, the reasons for rejecting alternatives as infeasible. So here, the city basically did everything right to comply with CEQA and achieved its desired result, although they didn't avoid litigation. So, okay. So this case out of Fresno addresses the question of what's a historical resource and who gets to decide what's a historical resource. So in 2011, Fresno approved a townhouse project that included demolition of two vintage homes. And you can see a picture of them right there. One was listed on the local register. The other had no listing. The city adopted an MND and found that the homes were not historical resources. So you see, one is on the local register, but the city is still saying it's not a historic resource. So in general, I think demolition of a historic resource requires an EIR. But these homes were not listed or eligible for listing in the California Register. And the locally registered home had a lot of degradation in its historic integrity over time. And the other home had no prior designation as historic. And so there was evidence that they were not historically significant, and had been extensively analyzed. So the city had a lot of facts in the record, and didn't just simply conclude they're not historic. And so in this case, the court deferred to the city's decision to determine whether or not these resources were historic in nature. And stated that CEQA doesn't require, every protection for every building that has any semblance of historic significance. I guess that's the new development. Okay, so what is adequate mitigation for an impact to a historic resource? In 2014, the city of Santa Ana approved a project to construct 22 homes on a locally listed historic site with a farmhouse and orange orchard. The project included restoration of the house and replanting a small grove of orange trees. So they still prepared an EIR, and they concluded that with the mitigation, the impact would be less than significant. Okay, so preservationists still were not happy with that, and sued the city, saying that the development of the site would be a substantial adverse change. But the court ruled in favor of the city and found that the project actually enhanced the historical significance of the property. And the construction of the new homes was compatible with the historic site. So, because the impact was less than significant, the city didn't have to adopt a statement of overriding considerations. Okay, so more locally, we are lucky to have with us the project planner for this local example, who I'm going to call on to tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, so this was a project from about 10 years ago, and many of you may remember that there was a nursery at the corner of California and Matilda. And this site was part of the larger Peary Park specific plan. And when the plan was being developed, there was already an interest from a developer to take the orchard site and build an office building there. And so during the Peary Park EIR, they had already included the sort of the significant impact of the loss of the property as part of their EIR. And the city council adopted a statement of overriding considerations. Then after that, the developer actually came in after the adoption of the Peary Park specific plan to develop the site and did a further analysis of the historic nature of the site. So what the story is that it's not just the house, which was built in 1906 by a San Jose architect, which is, let's see, I have to put my glasses on. It was Wolfe and Mackenzie, and it was a colonial revival house. And it was built in 1907. But prior to that, the land itself was one of the early subdivisions in Sunnyvale. And it was purchased or subdivided from a Murphy family that had owned a lot of property in the area. And Walter Everett Crossman, who is had partnered with the Murphy family to create subdivisions and really promote Sunnyvale as a location for people to come and purchase land. He called it the City of Destiny. And Walter Crossman himself, purchased this property and had owned it from 19, let's see, up until 1917. And it was a larger site that he owned the portion of the land that was part of, I guess, Central Expressway on ramp on Sobrante. So it was larger, but it was subdivided when the Central Expressway was created. Then after that, the Kirtner family owned it, or one of the daughters of the Kirtner family. That's famous developers or contributed to Silicon Valley, or not Silicon Valley, but San Jose, the development of South Bay. So they owned it until 1944. And then after that, the Mello family, who owned orchards and farms in Fremont and Mountain View, they purchased it and they had the property for like 80 years, 70, 80 years. And they had been using the property continuously from the time that Walter Crossman owned it as an orchard and nursery. So several layers of contribution to Sunnyvale's history there, not just the architect who designed the house was fairly known in the area, person who owned it and had, subdivided the property and also contributed to Sunnyvale's history. And also this was one of the last remaining nurseries that had been continuously an orchard and nursery. So there were several layers of a loss that could happen with the development of the site. And what ultimately happened was that the developer did put a lot of effort into restoring the house. So the previous photo that Sandy had shown was that because it had gone into quite a disrepair. And I actually went into the building with Trudy. And there were, like holes in the ceilings and floors and lots of debris in and outside. But it looks beautiful now. The inside has been converted to kind of a conference area, but they were able to preserve it and restore it in the exact location. And then they were able to take some historic photographs. And there is a plaque out on Matilda on their fence right now that you can take a look at when you have an opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Momo. Okay, so the city did a lot of work, even more than I knew, because the specific plan EIR also addressed this resource. So there was probably some tearing as well. Okay, so I'm getting towards the end of this presentation, and we just wanted to mention kind of CEQA's interaction with the new state housing laws, because I think there seems to be some tension between the state's desire to promote, I think, more and more housing, and the state's and how CEQA fits in, because the state has increasingly passed new housing laws that have made more approvals ministerial rather than discretionary. And so ministerial means that the city wouldn't have discretion to deny or impose additional conditions if it meets a certain set of kind of very clear and objective standards, similar to a building permit, because those have always been considered ministerial permits. But even the zoning or planning permits have increasingly become ministerial under state housing laws. And CEQA does not apply to ministerial approvals. So if an approval is ministerial, there is no CEQA review done. And so here are some of the more recent state housing laws. There have been a number of laws addressing accessory dwelling units. State law requires that city must approve ADUs ministerially, and ADUs cannot be prohibited in historic districts or parcels. And then there's a certain set of ADUs that the state mandates agencies to approve without applying any local standards. And for those, the city can't require a resource alteration permit. But for, other ADUs that kind of fall out of that mandatory or state-mandated category, what we call like non-streamlined ADUs, if they would alter a listed historic resource, they would still need a resource alteration permit, and that is a discretionary approval, which would trigger CEQA review. But there's most I don't know if it's most, but many ADUs are state mandated ADUs and therefore are completely ministerial without CEQA review. And then SB 35 seems so long ago. SB 35 was passed in 2017, but still with us, and has actually kind of established the site criteria for many subsequent laws that have turned housing approvals into ministerial approvals. And so basically on the site criteria, so projects, in order to use SB 35, they can't demolish any listed historic resources. So that's one of the criteria that SB 35 established and has been replicated in other laws. But that means there's no limit under SB 35 about development within historic or landmark districts. It's really about demolition of a listed historic structure. And then SB 9, which is the little bit more recent law about the lot splits and duplexes in single family districts, is that you can't use SB 9 either on parcels within historic districts and listed structures. So there's been, you know, some effort, I think, to kind of preserve historic resources, even while passing housing legislation. And that's generally true. I would just mention that there is a pending bill that has been significant concern among cities, SB 9, it's still kind of working its way through the legislature. And that basically makes a transit-oriented, would make transit-oriented development, you know, within a half mile of a major transit stop, an allowed use. So basically, and that one, that bill currently does not have a protection for historic resources. So, and that I think has been a concern for many agencies that value historic preservation. But there's about 3 to 4 weeks left in the legislative session, and we'll see what happens with that bill. And then, okay, so the final notes is that CEQA requires fully informed decisions with public participation about environmental impacts and alternatives when the city is approving projects. But CEQA alone can't stop demolition or significant alteration of a historic building or site. But it is a public engagement tool that allows for both public information and participation, and encourages like decision makers to take that into account, be fully informed before approving projects. Thank you.
Thank you. Do any commissioners have any comments or questions for staff?
There we go. Hi. Thank you for that wonderful presentation. That was, I really appreciate that. It's been a subject of curiosity for me for a while. I have some, perhaps some basic questions, if you would. Given that CEQA is an informational process and is not binding on the agency that is doing the process, would you say that all of the litigation is primarily about whether or not the process was followed, as opposed to having an effect on the overall project? I have three questions, by the way. That's the first one.
Okay. Yes, I think sometimes litigation is about process, but sometimes, I don't know if you would call this a process issue or a substantive issue, but oftentimes litigation is about whether or not the analysis was sufficient in the EIR. So, and whether or not there's mitigation measures that should have been considered, you know, other feasible mitigation. So I consider that more kind of substantive in nature.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of references to the agency, the city, and I want trying to get a handle on who all the players are,
Okay,
right? So
yeah, sorry. I think I was saying agency because I think the, usually these trainings say agency because that's the more generic term. I kind of flipped into city because I'm talking, I work for a city.
right.
We all serve a city. So I basically meant the same thing, city and agency interchangeably in the course of this presentation.
And the city or the commissions are responsible for the CEQA process, or is it the builder or developer who's responsible?
Great question. So the CEQA document is the city's responsibility or the public agency's responsibility because it's the public agency that is informing itself and the public about the impacts of a project that the agency is either undertaking itself. For instance, if the city was building a new parking garage, or if the city is providing funding for someone else's project, or if the city is issuing a permit for someone, a developer.
Right.
So before a city makes a decision, the city needs to inform itself and the public of the environmental impacts of the project. The environmental review is funded by the developer because this is all to process their development application. If it's a city project, the city would pay for the environmental review. But the city will engage the consultant who prepares the EIR. And so it is the city's document and responsibility.
Okay. Actually, I have an extra one after this. Sorry. We've been asked to consider an update to the Sunnyvale historical doc, places thing. Some of those proposals are places that we haven't decided yes or no if they're historical, but are they still presumptive if they're on our list of candidates for consideration for historical locations?
Yeah, I would say that it's presumptive. And if there is any future development on any of the sites that have been recommended so far that you reviewed, then each of those sites will need further review.
Okay. And the sort of bonus question was, it's kind of near and dear to me because I live over there by Old Orchard. There's a proposed development of the old Orchard Supply hardware lot with housing primarily. I presume there's a CEQA process going on for that project. It seems to be fairly significant and it seems to have a lot of impact on traffic and noise and whatnot. Where would that be represented in the city's documentation?
Yeah, so that project was approved by Planning Commission, and there was a CEQA review component to the project, and it was found to be in conformance with the LUT, which is the Land Use and Transport. Oh, and actually, El Camino, sorry, El Camino Specific Plan EIR.
Okay.
So there was an initial study, and there was a consultant that was hired to look at all the potential impacts for the development at the site. And the result of that, or the conclusion of that analysis, was that it would be in conformance with the findings that were already made in the El Camino Specific Plan EIR.
Okay. All right. And so that took place in planning, right? In
Yeah,
a planning commission meeting.
that's
Great,
right.
great. I'm wondering if we'll see one of these at some point. I'm sure we will. Thank you. That's all my questions.
Hi, I have a question regarding, is there a California database of CEQA approved cases that a city is able to reference easily? I know you have several examples in the presentation, but I'm wondering if you could elaborate if there's something that either it's available to the public or the city to look at that, especially if it comes up in the city and a city has never encountered that particular subject matter before, but another city has.
Yeah, so there's a lot of resources. I don't know if there's like a compendium of all of the cases, but there are many practice guides that will kind of summarize all the cases in all of the different areas that I talked about. Because this CEQA is a an area where there is a lot of litigation, there are typically annual legal updates that summarize the cases each year. And so this comes up in, I think, our like annual like city attorney trainings and annual the planning the APA conference. So, and many of those resources are public. Cal Cities will publish a CEQA update that they do twice a year. So there's many ways to kind of stay on top of what the evolution of CEQA is.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. And those are available also to the public or?
Many, the Cal Cities resources certainly are on the website and is available to the public.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you.
How many, just in terms of proportion, how many of the historic resources in Sunnyvale are listed or eligible for listing on the California list?
Well, the number of resources are on the Heritage Resources Inventory list. Now, in terms of how many of them are eligible for California Register or National Register, I'm not sure. It may be that some are already listed, but I don't have direct knowledge of that. Like, for example, the Mellows property was on our local register, and from what I understand, that property had also been on the California Register as well. So, perhaps I can do some research on that, but I think the database related to properties that are on the California Register is public information as well. So,
okay. It's more an idle curiosity than a significant matter, but thank you.
I think there may be lots of properties that, you know, if we do the research that could be listed, for example, some of the properties that we looked at as part of the technological innovations study. So it's just a matter of, you know, if there's interest in the property owner to register also, or if there's interest in the city to promote that as well.
In the case of a development that would affect those resources, who would, if the city's, I take it that that it would be the city's responsibility to assess whether the properties affected met the higher requirements for consideration under the, like, whether it's, I forgot, presumptive versus mandatory. Is that something that would be the city's obligation, and then litigation if someone happened to disagree strongly enough with the city?
Yes, it's the city. City determines whether or not the resource is a historic resource for purposes of CEQA, and whether or not it falls under the mandatory, presumptive, or, you know, other discretionary category. But if it falls into any of those categories, then it's considered a historic resource for purposes of CEQA, and the city has substantial discretion to decide that. It needs to be supported by substantial evidence, but you know, that is still, that just means there need to be facts in the record that support the decision.
Thank you. Do any other commissioners have comments or questions for staff? All right. We'll now move to oral communications. This is now the public's opportunity to address the commission on topics not listed on tonight's agenda and presentation item. This section is limited to 15 minutes and may be extended or continued after the public hearings / general business section of the meeting. Individuals may only speak once during oral communications. This commission meeting is a limited public forum, and the commission can regulate the time, place, and manner of speech. Speaker comments during oral communications must be limited to matters within the commission's authority, which is known as the commission's subject matter jurisdiction. If a speaker's comments are outside the commission's subject matter jurisdiction, the presiding officer will rule the speaker out of order. This allows the commission to conduct its business in a reasonably efficient manner and protects the rights of other speakers. A speaker will not be ruled out of order because of disagreement with the content of their speech. Please submit a speaker card to the recording officer, raise your digital hand now, or dial *9 on the telephone to indicate you wish to speak. I will now call on members of public participating in person. Were there any? Are there any?
There are no speakers, chair, for this item, whether in the room or online.
Okay. Then I will go ahead and close oral communications. I will go ahead and open public comment on consent calendar items. Are there any members of the public for consent calendar items?
Vice Chair, there are no members that are raising their hand online, neither a speaker card for consent, for the consent calendar. So you may ask the commission for a motion.
I will now close public comment and will ask for a motion from my colleagues.
About the approval of the minutes. Vice Chair, the consent calendar includes the draft minutes of January 23, 2025, item number 250799.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
We got the amendment from the previous meeting.
I second.
Thank you. As a point of order, the next button to approve the speaker is not working. My apologies to those I've been slow to approve. Is there a discussion or advocacy on the motion to approve the meeting minutes? All right, recording office.
Vice Chair, may I make a correction to the agenda? It seemed like there's a typo. The January 23rd meeting minutes were approved upon some revised changes on the vote. And I believe this item, the title has should be corrected to the March, the June meeting. So if you could redo the motion to approve the, it's the correct attachment and it's the correct item that's attached to the packet. It's just the title change to the June 4th, 2025 meeting minutes.
I move we approve the June 4th, 2025 meeting minutes.
Second. Is there discussion or advocacy on the motion? Recording officer, please conduct a roll call vote.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Vice Chair Saffir?
Yes.
Commissioner McManus?
Yes.
Commissioner Garrett?
Yes.
Commissioner Sharma?
Approved.
Commissioner Rajkumar?
Abstain.
Chair, we have four yeses with Commissioner Rajkumar abstaining and Commissioners Chair Johnson and Commissioner Rawal absent. The motion passes.
Thank you. So moving on, the next item is the selection of chair. Do we have any nominations from my colleagues?
I put my name in for chair.
I will also put my name in for chair.
I'd like,
Would you like to discuss the nominations that have been presented?
Does anyone, do any speakers, are there any commission members who would like to speak on the question of nominations? The
And this can be, and so just for kind of point of order, you can talk, you can, the nominees can talk about why they want to be chair if you want. So conceivably, now that you have two nominees, you, the nominees can talk, and then there's other advocacy. Before you go to vote, you do need to go to the public, just as a reminder from that standpoint.
Yes.
So we have two nominees, and share the mic if you can't, if the nominee that, both nominees should be able to speak if they want to, of course.
Yeah.
So the existing chair or, yeah.
I mean, I'll be brief. I, with my apologies for my confusion about how the script is structured tonight, I think that I will be able to run the meetings pretty efficiently, particularly after I have now run them once and have a better understanding of how the instructions of the script relate to the subjects and the items being presented. That is more or less my only consideration here.
So I would say in support of my own candidacy that I just have a strong background. I'm an attorney by training. I'm also getting a master's in urban planning at San Jose State. So I have a pretty solid background in planning, urban issues, procedure, things like that. And like Vice Chair Sofair, I also believe I can run a meeting very well. So thank you.
I think I will withdraw my nomination of myself for chair because I think I am happy to defer to your higher degree of subject matter expertise here. So
I just have a comment. I believe you both would do a really great job seeing how you have conducted the meeting today. I've been very, very impressed with your ability to lead the meeting, and either of you would make a great candidate. So I would encourage you to not withdraw, but I understand if you like to.
I am happy to, I'm happy to hand the metaphorical hat and take, and yeah. So do we have any public speakers on the subject of the selection of chair?
Vice Chair, we don't have any speaker cards in the room and we do not have any attendees.
Okay. Then the it is not clear by the script whether we vote on the chair or take it into nominations for vice chair next.
I think there may should be a motion by one of the commissioners.
Yes.
I move that we confirm our new chair.
Actually, vice chair, we could do this as a normal we could make a motion and we need a second, and after there's a second we could take a discussion and then take the vote.
Okay. Motion is made. Thank you. Motion is made and seconded.
I'm sorry, Vice Chair. May I ask who seconded the motion?
2 seconds.
Sorry, and who made the motion?
I didn't. So the current chair made the motion, and Sharma, and Sharma was the
thank you
first to second.
If there's no more discussion regarding the motions, I, with you, Vice Chair, I could start the vote.
Please.
Okay. Commissioner Sharma?
Yay.
Commissioner Rawal is absent. Commissioner Rajkumar?
Yes.
Chair Johnson is absent. Commissioner McManus?
Yes.
Vice Chair Safair?
Yes.
And Commissioner Garrett?
Yes.
Vice Chair, we have 5 yeses with Chair Johnson and Commissioner Rawal absent. The motion passes.
Thank you. Moving on to our next item, I will now ask for nominations for the selection of Vice Chair.
I'd like to nominate myself for Vice Chair. This is Commissioner McManus.
I'd like to nominate myself as Vice Chair as well.
Okay. Will the nominees please speak to your reasons for wanting to be Vice Chair?
I'll allow Mr. McManus, Commissioner McManus, to speak
first. Okay. Great. I've been on this commission now for a year and gotten sort of a handle of what's going on. And it is, I appreciate that it's a well-run meeting, much like Aaron does and Commissioner Garrett. And I've run a lot of meetings in the past. I've been manager, vice president, COO, so I know how to make a meeting run. And the only curious thing for me when I started was the Robert's Rules of Order, how the parliamentary procedure would get things going. But I feel like I got a good handle on that now. Thank you.
As your vice chair, potential vice chair, I would lead the meetings effectively. I'm quite familiar with leading the HPC meetings. I've actually served as chair prior to my previous a role in this position. So I'm well-versed in the proceedings and the script, and would happily fill in for Chair Garrett in his absence. In terms of leadership experience, I've had leadership experience in the managerial roles in the corporate world, as well as in leadership experience in clubs and extracurricular activities in and around the city as well. So I appreciate your vote and your confidence. Thank you.
Does anybody else have comments or questions? All right.
So, Vice Chair, the next step would be if there's no more other discussion regarding the nominations, we would ask for a motion
to move to a vote.
For a first and a motion for a second, and then proceeding to the vote.
And you also need to go to the public first, just as a reminder.
Yes. And do we have any members of the public?
Vice Chair, I do not see any speaker cards, and there are no attendees online.
Thank you. Then I will move for us to make, I will make
ask
a motion.
Ask for a motion. Make the motion.
I make a motion to move to a vote. Do I have a second?
Second.
Oh, I'm sorry. So can you
go for it.
Can you describe your motion?
To move to a vote on, I believe, is that not the next step on this matter?
The vote towards selection of
selection of vice chair.
Selection of vice chair of which nominee?
So you actually, you have two options. So I'll leave it to the vice chair. He's currently chairing the meeting to do this. You can either, one of two things, you can either take a motion and vote and get a second and then vote, which may be 3-2 or 2-3, or you can just basically poll the different members and they can choose either Shwarma or Garrett as their vote. So,
McManus.
Oh, sorry, McManus. Sorry about that. My first meeting here. But you have the option to do ultimately either of those.
Got it.
And then depending upon the vote, you would then make a motion just to certify that at the end.
Got it. Let's go with polling. If nobody objects, we'll just go down the table.
Or leave it to...
Or, Joe, is that a matter for you as the recorder, or is this an unofficial, or is that generally an unofficial matter that we just do?
Vice Chair, if you would like me to proceed with a polling, we could do that as mayor.
Yes, but if you would be so kind.
Okay, let's see. So the first poll would be, I can't do it electronically. I'm not used to setting that up right away, but we could poll for the first nominee of Commissioner McManus nominating, asking for a nomination for him to serve as vice chair. And I could start.
All they're looking for, so basically calling out the commissioner names at random and having them choose either McManus or Sharma. Sorry.
Got it. Sorry. Thank you, Mayor. I could start the polling. Commissioner Sharma?
Myself. Sharma.
Commissioner McManus?
McManus.
Commissioner Rajkumar?
Vote for Commissioner Sharma.
Who am I missing? Vice Chair Safair?
I will vote for Commissioner Sharma.
Did I miss anyone? The new Commissioner Garrett?
Commissioner Sharma.
All right. I'd like to bring this to a motion to certify that as the vote, or would we certify that as a vote or take an official vote?
Aye.
Thank you, Mayor. I'd like to put a motion to certify Commissioner Sharma as the new vice chair.
Second.
Was that Commissioner Sharma? Rajkumar, second. If there's no further discussion, I could take the vote.
Looks like no further discussion.
Hey, Commissioner Garrett?
Yes.
Commissioner McManus?
Yes.
Commissioner Rajkumar?
Yes.
Commissioner Sharma?
Yes.
And Vice Chair Safair?
Yes.
The motion passes with 5 yeses with Commissioner Chair Johnson and Commissioner Rawal absent.
All right.
That's 5-2.
Thank you. Congratulations, Commissioner Chair and Vice Chair. I will now close the public hearing. And I will ask for a motion to close the public hearing, I believe. No? And script, I don't understand why that's there. Yes, the next portion of the agenda is for oral reports and announcements by commissioners and staff to share information. Do commissioners have any non-agenda items or comments?
I'd like to, I know Commissioner, or excuse me, Chair Johnson is not in the room, but I'd like to thank her for her service, for serving as chair over the last year, and thanking yourself, Commissioner Sofair, for your service as vice chair over the last year. Very impressed with you both in leading our meetings.
Thank you, Vice Chair. And I agree that, and also I would like to thank Momo and the rest of staff for putting together and delivering their presentation.
Thank you. I do have a staff, if no other comments from the commissioners, I do have some reporting tonight. First, I would like to congratulate Chair Garrett and Vice Chair Sharma, and thank Chair Johnson and Vice Chair Sofair for serving as the chair and vice chairs for the Heritage Preservation Commission. Thank you, Commissioner McManus, for putting yourself out there. I thought it was great that we had such a robust selection process and so much interest from the commissioners. So I really appreciate that a lot, considering we don't have that many meetings. But however, we do have some upcoming projects coming your way, so I wanted to report on that. There is a study item to do a update to the historical context for the city of Sunnyvale. And the consultant that has been chosen is ARG, who is also the same consultants that were involved with the technological innovations reporting. So they will be coming to you in the next month or the month following to get your input on the, they'll go over the context of the study issue and provide some ideas in terms of what they need to study. And most of this is a historical context update related to Asian residents or citizens of Sunnyvale and their contributions and other minorities' contributions in Sunnyvale. So they're looking at updating that as part of their study. So they'll be sharing their project scope and requesting input from you. And then at some other point, once they have prepared the documentation, they'll have a presentation to share with you. So that's exciting. The Murphy's Law Tavern on Murphy Avenue, so this is a landmark district, that property is being renovated right now. They have a tenant improvement by Zareen's, which is a Indo-Pakistani restaurant, which is very popular in many other cities. So they're locating there. And we have an application from them to do a facade update and also some other architectural updates. So that requires a landmark alteration permit, which is under your purview. And it is actually my project, so I'll be bringing it to you in the next few months as well. And then in terms of the technological innovations, historic resources inventory study item, so that was stalled for a few months due to a contract extension requirement. And so there was an administrative process that was required for us to put a break on it until it went through the sort of the finance processes to be able to extend the contract. And the contract now has been extended to March of 2026. And we will be coming back to you with a final report. Some of the input that we received from yourselves and the public will be incorporated into the final report. And part of that actually would be to look at the Fry's site. And it actually won't be the Arquez site, which is surprising. The first Fry's is somewhere else in Sunnyvale. So we will be able to share that information with you at that time. So that is it. And if there are any other projects, we will be certainly coming back to you with that as well.
That is very exciting news.
I just like to thank Momo for that update. I know that's something we had requested, I think, in the January meeting, is to receive updates of where our current projects are. So we really, I really appreciate that summary to know where we are in the process. Would it be possible, I know we had requested this in the January meeting, but to have that as a as part of our packet for the meeting?
Yeah, I will speak to our administrative staff and see if that could be included. Thank you.
And I have a quick comment. So thank you for allowing me to be here. I'm happy to be the liaison for this commission for the next 6 months. You know, here I was on the Historical Society board many years ago. And so the history of the city is really forefront in my mind. So hopefully, you know, I'll get to know you all a little bit better. This is one of the things I love about being liaison, is kind of cycling through the different commissions and getting to know the different commissioners better. Hopefully I'll remember your first and last names a little bit better by the end of the 6 months. I just want to congratulate the new chair and vice chair. There is chair and vice chair training that'll be coming up at the beginning of September. And so staff will be contacting you that just to help you get through the taking on the reign of running these meetings. But thank you for stepping up, and thank you for those that have served in the past, and look forward to working with you over the next 6 months. Thank you.
Vice Chair, there's one item that may have been missed unintentionally. There's a standing item, consideration of potential study issues. So I just wanted to verify if any of the commissioners have any potential study issues that they would like to share with the commission.
Does any commissioner have any such issues?
So quick question for staff. If what comes to me later, can I send you a suggestion, or does that have to come through here?
So this is a part of the agenda for every meeting. So if there is something that you would like to bring up, I would encourage you to share it at the commission at the next meeting.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Are there any information only reports or items? All right. Then there's no, I don't believe that there's a motion needed to adjourn the meeting. No. Then this meeting is adjourned at 8:33. And I want to thank everyone for their participation in tonight's meeting.